Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... I got the charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink? This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera. Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
What does it mean to live a life that is worth living? Well, fortunately, there's a book about it, Life Worth Living, A Guide to What Matters Most by three Yale professors and teachers who teach an extremely popular course at Yale about life called Life Worth Living. Miroslav Volf, Matthew Kroesman, and Ryan McNally-Lins. Miroslav came on the podcast to talk about his new book. I have to say, this book really moved me. There were so many like excellent stories and so much wisdom about how to live a life worth living. And it really changed my opinion about several things. And I had a lot of questions for Miroslav. So here they are. Here's Miroslav. I'm grateful he came on the podcast. The book is Life Worth Living and lifeworthlivingbook.com, where you could also download a discussion guide about the book. Also, throughout the book, there's questions you can ask yourself to challenge you to think about what is a life worth living for you. So anyway, here's Miroslav, and we're talking about a life worth living. I highly recommend it.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Miroslav Volf, thank you for coming on the podcast, and thank you for writing this book. What got you into doing this course?
Yeah, initially what got me into it is kind of realization triggered by a book by a colleague of mine, Tony Kronman, titled Education's End, on why American colleges and universities have given up on the meaning of life. And he analyzes kind of development of higher education, starting with Harvard in the United States, above all, starting with Harvard and how the question of the meaning of life, what kind of life is truly worth living, was at the heart of university education. And even so, when those universities started secularizing and became more secular until about 70s, that's his argument. I'm not always persuaded by kind of details of the argument, but main point about marginalization of the question seems to me right, which meant then that instrumental reason, explanatory reason started dominating a university education, and the kind of purposes of life, meaning of life, become increasingly marginalized.
Can I ask what you mean by explanatory reasons?
I mean that it's your explanation of the phenomena, of the nature of reality in various domains. And the other, I say instrumental reason, because basically I put it this way, it helps you get from whatever point A you are to whatever point B you want to get.
Can you give an example of how is that different from questioning what is the meaning of life? Or what is a life worth living?
Well, I think that what is a life worth living or meaning of life is a question about purpose, question about should. So I think the central issue for me is that how do I answer the question, what kind of life is worthy of my humanity? What kind of life is worth living? Not what I want to live, but what kind of life I should live. How do I answer this should question? And I don't think the should question can be answered by appealing either to some kind of inner depth of the self, something like authenticity, my own individual character, my own dreams, and my own deepest desires. And I don't think it can be either answered satisfactorily by looking at kind of sciences. You can get advice from sciences in terms of what kinds of means would be appropriate to whatever ends you want to achieve. But the ends question, what kind of life I should live, that seems to me untouched by these or unaddressed by these dominant ways in which we privately think about our lives and in which we sometimes publicly think about them as in universities.
Well, maybe we can use this. You have a lot of different examples in the book, and it seems like each example, the answer to how to find meaning in your life or how to live a life worth living changes depending on the perspective of the story you're telling, whether it's Buddha or Abraham Lincoln or Martin Luther King or Jesus or James Baldwin. And in a lot of the perspective is from an individual point of view. Some of it is from a societal point of view. Maybe we could break down how did Abraham Lincoln or Martin Luther King differ from Buddha, say, in their perspective? Because both had you could say all those people had lives worth living, but very different answers to the question, what is a life worth living?
Yeah, they've given a kind of a different accounts of what it means to life worth living. I mean, as I think, for instance, let's compare Buddha and Martin Luther King. It seems to me that for Martin Luther King, the question of kind of what we call circumstances of our lives, that is to say, what kind of setting is appropriate to a life? What kind of set of relationships is appropriate to a life that is truly worth living, a world that is truly worth aspiring? That question was at the center of Martin Luther King's endeavor. Attempt to reach beloved community, wider extent to situate that beloved community in a certain way in which we go about creating goods in life in terms of economic justice, in terms of political sets of relationship. I think those were at the margins of the concern of the Buddha. Buddha was interested in kind of more about internal space and how the self situates itself within the world. And what we do in this course is we basically approach the vision of the good life by saying that the good life or life worthy of our humanity has these three mutually related dimensions. One dimension is that of my agency. The other dimension is that of the setting in which I am, the circumstances. And the third dimension is that of emotions, of affect. How do these three figure in each of the vision of life that we analyze? That's a really interesting question that we pursue.
So let me ask about those three things. So the first one was agency, meaning perhaps if that's the only thing you focus on, then a life where I have as much individual choice on my actions as possible is one worth living.
Yes, and it would be something, your actions is what you really have under control. A Stoic might say your circumstances really cannot determine what kind of life is worthy to be lived, because circumstances will change and you have to have that kind of stability of core to yourself. Therefore, you concentrate on your agency. And if emotions come, they will be a kind of a result of proper orientation in terms of agency in life, but they're not worthy of pursuit in and of themselves.
Right, and as Stoics would point out, both Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius were, let's say, equally great Stoics in terms of understanding that regardless of the circumstances, they had, you know, choice of their mood and virtue in their lives. And Epictetus, of course, born a slave, Marcus Aurelius, an emperor, and yet equally were able to pursue agency, hence Stoicism. And so the next thing was you discuss how the setting could determine how you live a worthy life. And you could argue Martin Luther King, his setting was a world with not the civil rights he wanted. So he pursued a life where he wanted to change that, to create greater civil rights.
Yeah, and behind that lies the question that, of course, it's important to have a right set of agency, but you can be also in a significant ways constrained as an agent in the world. And that constraint represents a modes of injustice that you suffer. And you have to then construe a kind of a world in which one is able truly to flourish. It's almost like you think of yourself as a plant, and not every soil will be appropriate, not every environment will be appropriate for you to grow. And the vision there is that actually, as he put it himself, that actually I cannot flourish truly myself until everyone else in the world flourishes. And so that flourishing of all, flourishing of even entire environment, though that was not in the forefront of his attention, is essential for each person to be really living a life as they are called to, as is worthy of their humanity. And in that sense, though certain way of accessing a life worthy of our humanity is there for us, whether we are slaves or free, we ought to aspire to more than that.
And it's interesting because let's take Buddha and Martin Luther King again. Buddha is not trying to change the world. He, like as you mentioned, he's trying to live as an example of how one could uplift one's personal, individual sort of inner space. And Martin Luther King, of course, is trying to change the world. And both probably equally and positively affected tens or even hundreds of millions of people in their lifetimes and after. And yet both very different. Buddha could have gone out and been a king and chose not to be, not to change the external world, but in doing so, attracted people to his vision. Martin Luther King didn't sit for his entire life in a grove and attract people to him, but he went out there in the world to affect change. It's hard to reconcile the two to know how to live one's life. And so where do you come down on that? I know the book doesn't have one answer to a life worth living. There's, you know, pick a card here, pick a card, any card.
Well, except that I wouldn't quite put it pick a card on any card. I think the first...
Yeah, that might be a better way to put it.
The first part of what you said is quite right. And what we try to do in the book, we realize that each person is responsible for their own life. Ultimately, your life is in your own responsibility. You may ask then, well, to whom am I responsible to live it in a certain way? But still, you have to decide how you would live. But how do you decide? And what we are suggesting and what this book hopefully embodies is what we call truth-seeking conversations. What I don't think we should do is look at those sages and exemplars and then think, well, what kind of resonates with me? What do I like? As if these were there on the smorgasbord of life choices. And then you choose depending on what kind of meal you feel like eating today. I think what we want to say is that there is something deeply earnest and significant. Something that can be lost if we don't live our lives in the way that's worthy of our humanity. We have exemplars of folks who failed as humans. Now, that's very hard to hear sometimes, that you can fail not in a particular endeavor that you undertake, which we all know, which we all fail and maybe learn from our failures and so forth, but you can fail as a human being. That's a much more consequential failure. And that means that we have to take this question in the way in which I think these traditions normally did take them, namely that they articulate a truth about human existence. Now, you might say, well, all these tend to conflict. They partly overlap, but in significant ways, they also differ. And then what we do, we invite our students in the class that we teach and also in this book, we invite people to try to think themselves into those positions and then critically evaluate the impact on them, on others, but take them seriously as making those claims to truth rather than simply appealing to their attunement, emotional fit between them and that vision that they encounter.
That's really a good point, because it could change throughout your life. Like maybe at some points you're concerned with, you know, your own inner desires and rejections and cravings. And so you work on that because you feel working on that will point you in the right direction. And then other times you see injustice in the world and you work on that and you feel that becomes a life worth living. So it doesn't have to be like one set of beliefs that drive you through an entire life. And you start off with the book with searching for what is the right question to ask. And by the way, one thing I really love in this book is at the end of each chapter, you have a section called Your Turn. And, you know, and there's exercises for the reader. Like, you know, here's one from chapter 5. Like, you ask questions like, what should we hope for? What are genuinely good circumstances? How much is enough when it comes to these circumstances? And there's no real answer to these questions. But like you said, they're enough to think about. Like some people might say, oh, I need $10 million and, you know, a certain political party to be president, and then I'm in genuinely good circumstances. And then you could question, is that true? And, you know, and like you say in the very next question, where should we set the horizon of our hopes? That's a moving target for many people. And it kind of goes back and forth between all these philosophies. But let's start with the initial thing. What is a good question to ask to set us on the road of finding out what is a life worth living?
I think for me, the good question to set off that search is to ask, what do I want? Do I really want what I want? And if I really want what I want, should I want what I want? So as to come from the very surface observation of our desires. And that's the mode in which we generally function. We have a desire, we satisfy a desire. An ideal case scenario would be that that's really the good life that we live, that our desires are fitting to the kind of life that we ought to live. But often we just have desires and then find ourselves, oh, wait a second, how did I come to desire this? Is this really what I want? Am I getting what I want out of this? Having this desire satisfied. And you might realize, I'm being left unsatisfied. And then you start thinking about what is it really that I want? And then you ask, well, should I want that? What's at stake in me wanting it? And what might I lose if I pursue that which I really want, which then takes you to this idea of what kind of life I should live. And then we find it helpful to say, okay, once you ask this question, ask yourself, what kind of agency should you pursue? What kind of circumstances and what kind of emotions? And as you said earlier, I fully agree with you, at different stages of our lives, maybe even at different times of a single day, I might want to concentrate on one thing rather than on the other thing. But what I would try to urge is that even when we concentrate on different things, whether on circumstances or agency or emotions, that nonetheless we keep the whole of our lives together, because these three elements, these three aspects of life inform one another. And it's very important to be clear what I want in each one of those and why I want.
Yeah, it's so interesting, because being clear about exactly what it is you want, even if it's minutes of a day or single years of your life or whatever, and then being consistent, you know, then figuring out what actions there are and then being consistent with it. Like, I like your example of Thomas Jefferson, where he writes, he wants to, in 1776, he writes, he wants to abolish slavery, but then he doesn't quite do it. And so he's not quite consistent in his actions. And so that's interesting. Like, clearly, can you say Thomas Jefferson lived a life worth living? Because in many ways he did, but then there's this, as he even labeled it, it's just an evil thing.
Yeah. Slavery. Yeah, I think that's right. And most of us find ourselves in that kind of a situation where in some domains of our lives, we live a life that is worthy of our humanity, at least the way we understand it. And that's really a wonderful, wonderful thing. But in other domains, we don't. And I think it's very, very important to realize that it's not, for us, it was very important as academics in particular, it was very important to realize it's not enough just to have a clear vision of what truly good life is. You have to translate that vision in daily actions, and you not only have to translate it in daily actions, it has to become a kind of a habit, your second nature. Then we are at our best, right? Then it's not a life good life, life worthy of our humanity, is not simply a matter of striving and failing. It's also a matter of a kind of slipping on to a very comfortable shoes and running without having sense that it's I'm at odds, my feet are at odds with what they are wearing. And that's really the goal in this whole progression from discerning to kind of identifying with what one discerns, to then translating what one discerns in action, and to making out of actions kinds of habits so that I can fully live identified with the vision of life that I have embraced.
Yeah, and I guess also giving yourself permission for that vision to change so that, you know, like take Buddha is such a fascinating example. It's a very complex, it's much more complex emotionally when you look at the Buddha story. Like when he was a prince and he had everything, he didn't quite feel fulfilled when he met the monk who seemed very satisfied. But in order to make the change from prince to Buddha, he basically had to abandon his child on the day his child was born. And of course, he goes back for that child later, and that's a beautiful story as well. But you see, there's a very, it's almost inconsistent with goodness the way he leaves his child to seek his own personal salvation. And again, it's complex because that personal salvation then became a religion for hundreds of millions of people. It's a very complex story, and I don't really know what to make of it, because when you really attempt to be without craving, if Martin Luther King had decided to live a life like that, maybe he would never have pursued, you know, rights for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and vice versa, if Buddha had tried to effect change in his kingdom, maybe he would have been an inspiration for hundreds of millions of people later.
And he would have had a very different vision of a good life. So I think the one telling thing about the Buddha is when he thinks, if he's renounced his wealth, at least his son should get that wealth. And Buddha doesn't think in that way, because he thinks if he leaves him wealth, that's going to be an impediment for him, right? That's going to prevent him from reaching the kind of life that is truly worth living. Now, you can obviously think, well, this seems like it's a crazy, crazy idea. But nonetheless, that's at the very heart of the Buddhist vision of life. Just like, for instance, I mean, very interesting, and we have also example of that in the book, when we discuss kinds of emotions that one ought to have. It seems like, oh, it would be just natural. We have emotions, they feel good, which is just pursue those emotions. And generally we think, okay, pleasure is very good, pleasurable emotions. And yet, you know, the different traditions have thought differently about it, and it's worth stopping and thinking. And then the question was, what is it that a Buddhist, a follower of the teaching of the Buddha, should actually feel? And it's not so much a pleasure, and it's not so much kind of exhilaration of joy or something like that. It's something much more subtle, a kind of serenity in life that is unperturbed by circumstances that come one's way, or sometimes by the comforts of our bodies as well. And that seemed to me really worth thinking about and kind of aligning our lives to find kind of emotional way to live that is sustainable over periods of time.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, "Good things come to those who wait." I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Why do you think Buddha is often portrayed as being somewhat heavy? You know, you see the fat Buddha sitting, you know, when probably he wasn't heavy, but particularly like in the more Eastern countries, China, Japan, when the Buddha is portrayed, he's often portrayed as being quite pleasantly satiated with food.
You know, that's a wonderful question, and I'm not sure that I really know the answer, but I've always thought of it as there is this base, unperturbed serenity that can be then expressed in the form of kind of rounded shape of the body, right? It's kind of chubby, a chubby person. It fits less, and especially how he's portrayed as being chubby, befits less somebody who is purely into hedonistic pleasure. It befits less somebody who is, you know, stoically marching through life, notwithstanding the circumstances. There's a kind of beautiful serenity that describes that is expressed in the very way in which the Buddha is portrayed.
And this, you know, and this is obviously, this is not, your book is not about Buddhism, but Buddha is one example among many in the book. But he's very complex in that he very much does what he wants to do. So even when he goes back for his son 6 years later after leaving, and you don't mention this part of the story in your book, but his wife and his father actually beg him, do not take your son, Rahula. Let him stay here, yeah. Get your material inheritance, your wealth, and become king. Please do not take him. And what does the Buddha do? And this is where your book talks about it. He thinks about what the word inheritance means, and he realizes his true gift to his son is to believe in the same beliefs he has of the Four Noble Truths. And so he basically takes Rahula with him, defying his wife that he hasn't seen in 6 years and defying his father. And it's almost a little bit cruel, but his higher purpose is this. He kind of believes in this absolute truth of, you know, salvation of the soul is salvation of everyone, really, which is very different from how other people might feel.
Yeah, and I think you can give different examples from different traditions in the same way. I mean, in Jewish tradition, think of Abraham and his own leaving of his home, at least the way it's portrayed in the book of Genesis, or the story of near sacrifice of Isaac. Think of Jesus as well. There's kind of a severity in those teachings, which I think it's bear reflecting upon. I personally, for myself, think that a kind of such a fundamental reorientation in values that is embodied in all three of these examples, willingness to undergo this is fundamental for the stance that says, you know, my life is too precious to be squandered. My life is too precious for me to constantly also experiment with it. I want to live my life in a way that I would be at one with the true purpose that I find for my life. And in order to do that, you have to kind of endure what we at the beginning of the book say a wreck for your life. This book might wreck your life, right? It may detract you for a moment, at least, or permanently from the direction that you are taking. But in a sense, you're one of yourselves dies for another to be truly born and to be lived in a way that that you find yourself, not that somebody else imposes on you, that you find yourself to be truly in tune with your humanity.
You know, it's so interesting because, again, there's like three perspectives. There's the perspective of yourself right now. Am I experiencing pleasure or not? And you give good examples with Oscar Wilde. So first, let me say the perspective. There's the perspective of you as an individual experiencing pleasure. There's this perspective of you doing good for society. So that broadens out the picture a little bit. And then there's a perspective of you in terms of an ultimate truth about the universe or the world. And it's almost like the right questions to answer is where you fit in on all of those spectrums, those three spectrums: individual pleasure, societal correctness or goodness, and or universal truth. And it's almost like we have three levers where we can decide where we fit in on all three of those spectrums to determine what our life would be worth living. And those levers could be adjusted. If I'm summarizing the book with an analogy,
I think that might be a helpful way to do it. We use it with the help of recipe, right? You have to put these different elements and dimensions of the good life. You have to hold them together. We express as well, you have to have recipe, and not all ingredients are fitting to be part of the recipes. You can combine them, different ingredients, but some of them will just not fit the recipe at all. And therefore, you have to be conscious of how you adjust those elements. You put it also very nicely in terms of levers. All three have to be in play, but what would dominate and what would be subordinate might differ from person to person. And as you've earlier pointed out rightly, it may differ for a particular single person in the course of their lives.
Yeah, and it's worth bringing up the Oscar Wilde example from the book. Like early in his life, he pursued, maybe you can call it more hedonistic pleasure. I'm not there's nothing wrong with that. He enjoyed it, and it too is a life worth living. And then he kind of, as he grew older, he sort of morphed into maybe more silent pleasures like reading and thinking and, you know, things like that. But he pursued mostly pleasure and happiness, which is nothing wrong with that. And, you know, in the case of Abraham Lincoln or Martin Luther King, it's more like, you know, a life worth living for them was maybe one filled with sacrifice. Like they were willing to give their lives essentially for some greater societal good. And these are almost extreme examples. Like Lincoln and Martin Luther King literally gave their lives for a greater good in society. And Oscar Wilde, he risked jail and did face jail pursuing pleasure. And Buddha and Jesus and those who followed, you know, his initial disciples basically gave up society in order to pursue what they felt was a life worth living.
Yeah, I think some of those choices are kind of serendipitous. They happen in the course of life. Maybe that's what happened to Oscar Wilde for a while, and he had to undergo crisis in order to kind of recalibrate himself. And some of them are a matter of, that's okay. I choose one rather than the other. Because it's important to me now. But others, on the other hand, are not so much choices. I'm wondering whether when Oscar Wilde says, well, we kind of squandered, I squandered my talent in just kind of sheer hedonism, right? And you think, well, right, if I were Oscar Wilde, and now from perspective as a reader of him, I think, well, I wish he had a little bit fewer of these so that we as humanity can benefit from him much, much more. And the same thing could happen, you would think about Martin Luther King. It's not, I suppose at some level you would say it's okay if he doesn't do what he's doing. But on the other hand, you say, well, it wouldn't have been okay. The path that he chose, the calling that he chose, it's kind of exemplary for him, but it's also, or it's characteristic of him, but it's also exemplary for us. If we don't do in similar situation as Martin Luther King does, there's kind of something telling me I'm not quite living up to what I possibly could, and I might be failing in a significant way.
You know,
is that too harsh?
No, but it's interesting because ultimately all of these people had their successes and failures, but like take Gandhi, that, you know, who Martin Luther King was greatly influenced by.
Yeah.
Was he a success? He freed India, quote unquote, freed India from the British Empire. But the UK, the United Kingdom, was slowly unraveling its empire anyway. And, you know, ultimately the India that came out of the UK, you know, was split by religious strife, ultimately split into three different countries. There was constant wars and battles, and, you know, they took a step backwards as a developing country for a while. Now they're accelerating very well. But, you know, you could argue, was it worth it, him pursuing a greater good, when he didn't fully know what would happen, even though his intentions were good?
Yeah, and in some ways, I think you point to very, very important and element on unpredictability of life. And if you assess the value of life only against the backdrop of consequences, you might as well be second-guessing yourself all the time what's kind of worth doing. I think many of the traditions would say the consequences might be important, but what you ought to pay attention to something more than just consequences of your deeds. Indeed, some would say you can completely disregard consequences as a kind of moral, strictly issue. And of course, that's another big philosophical, if you want, religious issue to debate about. But it's important to keep in mind, right? So that one might say, even if he failed in terms of consequences, what he was aspiring to do and the kind of life that he led had its own integrity that merits deep honoring and identifying with, and then might cause you to think, well, how should I assess my life?
And it's interesting too that a lot of this is about creativity. Like you look at Oscar Wilde, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, Buddha, Jesus or his disciples, there's a certain creativity in sort of looking at the world and seeing, oh, things can be wildly different, and that might be the life worth living. So take the disciples who you give as an example. I mean, he wants to follow Jesus, and he says to Jesus basically, hey, but first I got to just bury my dad who just died. And Jesus says, let the dead bury the dead. And he's not just referring to father, right? He's metaphorically referring to everybody in traditional society is living a kind of walking dead sort of life, but pursuing your personal relationship with God immediately, without doubt, without hesitation, is a life worth living. Like Jesus basically underlines the immediacy of it. Like, you can't even bury the dead. You gotta, you know, move now. I wonder, you know, it's this ability to be so open-minded, you can change your life completely as a way of moving forward.
One might ask whether that's a prudent thing to do. If my son came to me and asked me that kind of a question, I'd wait a second.
Slow down, even though
I'm a Christian, I identify with this thing. and I would think, but to me, it means also a kind of willingness not to be simply caught in the stream and follow what's around me. Said you articulate that in terms of creativity, in terms of being able to see your future self, the world's future self, so to speak, in a different way. And then this extraordinary thing as making a wager with your life in order to move in that direction. That in itself, that ability to do that, and the effects that some of the wagers of this sort have had upon humanity, to me is really actually extraordinary.
I'll emphasize what you said earlier about the book, is that it's not necessarily, none of these stories are a recipe for how to live one's life. They're just stories, and you have to, the individual has to sort of decide. But, you know, so no one suggests just give up everything and let the dead bury the dead. But, you know, I'll give a counterexample from the book. You talk about the Bhagavad Gita from Hinduism and Arjuna's discussion with Krishna on the battlefield. Arjuna suddenly decides he doesn't want to kill his cousins, even though he's on the righteous side of a war and the cousins are on the bad side. But Krishna explains the concept of dharma, like this is the right thing. Don't shirk now from what the right thing is, what your dharma is. But then the flip side is, you could argue Peter, his quote unquote dharma, to use a Hindu term to describe Peter, his dharma was to be a fisherman and to live that life and live a good life that way. The real critical thing is, are you asking the right questions as opposed to, are you changing your life radically?
I think that's right. And are you sufficiently informed in when you are asking some of these questions, especially since in earlier times, the life was lived in certain kinds of grooves. Traditional societies, you followed in the footsteps of mainly your parents. Under extraordinary circumstances, were you able to break out of those? We no longer live in such societies, very mobile. Each of us is making our own decisions for our lives, even though under constraint of many forms of circumstances. And in situations as we modern folks live, you have to have at least some sense of what you're doing when you're making your choices. And for me, it's a question, do I just follow my dream that I haven't sufficiently thought through and know whether it has weight? Or do I step back and at different points in my life, take resources that I need and try to reflect about courses of life and then take courage to act in a way that is more in sync with not just my dream or desire, but something that has been informed more deeply that will let me avoid living a life that is too light. Milan Kundera's unbearable lightness of being, right? Kind of that always skirts on some surface. It's kind of maybe even fun and enjoyable, but ultimately it's a foam and it's not a substance.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... I love the charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink? This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera. Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
In The Unbearable Lightness of Being, just when the main character kind of deepens his relationships, and including his relationship with himself and his life, that's when he dies. And so in some sense, Milan Kundera is saying that when you're willing to change, there's also potentially going to be consequences that are unknown and could be not what you want. But I think again, it leads to the fact that, are you asking the right questions? And I think that's why I love how you have this, not quite homework, but these questions. Like for instance, and this one is from chapter one, think back non-judgmentally over the last few days. You say, what questions have been on your mind? Write down your observations. And then you say, stepping back, at what layer do you feel most comfortable? Where do you like to spend your time? Do any of the layers of reflection make you afraid? And I think that's very interesting. Like, because why do you want to know, or why do you ask yourself, does anything make you afraid? What does fear have to do with deciding if a path is worth living?
Well, I think you need to articulate it so that you know that it's actually present and operating. And maybe the fear is wise and is warning you against something that is true danger, but maybe fear is foolish and is preventing you from taking the path that actually would be more difficult, maybe a bit scary, but much more promising. And so I think this kind of taking stock of where I am in an honest way is important for the right decisions to be made. And fears are, especially when it comes to decisions that mark our trajectories of our entire life, they're understandable. When I was adolescent, I'm now 66, and I think back, and I should have been completely paralyzed by making a choice, choices that I'm making, that directing the arrow of my longing in a particular direction. Who knows what would have happened? And yet,
well, when you were young, what did you want to do when you grew up?
Oh, well, when I was young, pretty early on, I wanted to be a philosopher and a theologian, so which is what I became. But I'm not sure that when I was that kid, if I were that kid right now, not knowing what became of me, whether I would have gone that route. I could have never in a million years imagined that I would be sitting at Yale teaching at a wonderful institution. And yet, I think I kind of admire my adolescent self. It was an unpopular thing to do. And I did it. And
yeah, everybody wanted to be like a millionaire or a doctor or whatever.
Or in my time, a theologian would have been worse. I was living in former Yugoslavia.
So it was against the law.
Yeah, basically against the law. You have doomed yourself to a kind of meager existence, or maybe having to scrape your existence doing something else so that you can do the thing that you really, really enjoy.
But you know, the fear there for you was important because it kind of moves the compass about what direction you should go. So like, obviously there's fear. You're going to live. So on the one hand, you could not have fear and you could say, I can't do that. That's just not done in my society.
Yeah.
Or you could say, listen, this is what I want to do, but fear tells me I'm going to make a meager life and I might be, you know, doing something against the government's laws. The government was not in favor of religion at all. It was a communist government back then. And take Peter again as an example. He could have said to Jesus, I can't do that. I need to bury my father. But instead, it's a meta way of looking at it. I notice I'm feeling fear. So why am I feeling that fear? Is it a constraint of society? Is it a constraint? Is it really the case that I can't leave right now? Like, I think fear could be a meta way of breaking down what you initially thought was an immutable problem, but actually turns out to have a solution. Oh, there actually aren't, you know, it actually might be better for me to leave right now. Or for you, I need to move to America at some point and pursue this there because it's a better place to do it. And so fear really could direct you.
Yeah, I think that's quite right. I fully agree with you. And then one can work through one's fear when one articulates them. One can also taking stock of what I do, how I spend time, for instance. I mean, one thing is for me to think about what's in my mind, what my desires are and what my dreams are. Well, it's another thing to say, let's sit down and see how I spend time. Let's sit down and decide where do I actually, when left to my own devices, where do I pour my energies and discover what actual desires and proclivities are, and then I can honor them. I can also say, you know, that's really not what I should be doing. I've got to wake up. How do I do that?
Yeah, and again, a lot of it is questioning, like, you know, the questions that you have at the end of each chapter. You know, like for instance, right before part three, there's a page of questions, and one of the questions is, "How should we live?" And so you're basically saying, what ends should we seek through our agency? What standards should we be held to? And so on. So this is kind of more on the, when your perspective is on the societal level, like, you know, what should we do? And what's our or maybe not on the societal level, but what should we do to live a life worth living? But what actions does that imply? Does that imply leaving life behind to reduce craving? Does that imply being an activist to make the world a better place? And so on. And these, again, are questions always worth asking. Like, and you point out a very kind of common example. Is it worth it to binge on Netflix TV shows? And on the one hand, it sounds trivial to binge on Netflix TV shows and nobody should do it because that might not be a life worth living. But then I was thinking about it. I love TV shows and I love hearing stories and watching stories. Yeah. And for me, it's part of my life worth living, I think. Although I guess I should always question it, is watching stories. And that's what I love about watching TV.
Yeah, and the question is also not whether one should ever binge on a particular series, as I did most recently watching The Empress. I don't know.
Oh, I haven't watched that one.
I really liked it. It's only six episodes in this first season. It was pretty. I thought pretty good.
That's barely a binge, by the way. I binged on Lost, which is 120 episodes.
Well, but in a sense, felt to me like two evenings or something like that were completely claimed by this series, and I think it was a good use of my time. I learned something. I enjoyed the story and the struggles that are being portrayed. So it's a matter of what kinds of balance I find in my life. Whether my life one simple binging, right? That may be a really extreme way to ask that question, but that is, I think, how some lives tend to be, a kind of simply following the kind of internal cravings, and some of those may be fantastic. And actually, as I mentioned earlier, the goal is actually for your cravings to befit exactly the life as it ought to be lived, right? So that what you deeply desire is in sync with what you have found that you should be doing with your life. And maybe that's for you the case.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, and it's interesting. You start off the book talking about the question. Like, you don't say, this is the life worth living, but but you're again using examples and questions, and you capitalize question, but I'll get to that in a second. It's really the, how you pursue the questioning of a life worth living. And you give these stories to tell from history to tell how different people, characters ask these questions. But I like the fact that you capitalize question because for I never noticed this before, but the word quest is in question. And I don't know if that was intentional by the creators of language, but you know, it is a quest. Like how one lives one life is a quest. And it starts with the question of what am I pursuing? What is the goal of this quest is the question. And I just noticed this for the first time on reading your book, maybe because questions stood out because it was capitalized all the time. But have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, no, we did. And I think there is a sense in which our whole life is a quest, right? We never fully get to answer the question so that we can just pursue that answer. We always also question how, even if we are set a direction for ourselves, how to live that in the here and the now, so that this type of, if you want, reflective accompaniment of life by asking questions and seeking answers is really fundamental to our life. You know, Socrates and his proverbial unexamined life is not worth living. I think it applies if it doesn't mean simply let me analyze myself, right? Because that kind of life may end up being trite, actually. But unexamined life is not worth living. If you go in a particular direction without you examining where it is going, how are you getting there, and whether that befits who you are and who you are supposed to be, that turns out generally not to be life worth living.
Yeah, and you know, I want to ask some specific questions about some words and phrases you use. Like, you describe the difference between friendship and companionship, and I thought that was a very interesting distinction. Do you want to describe?
Yeah, it seems to me that friendship, at least how we use it in the book, it describes something much deeper, some kind of a shared fundamental orientation in an endeavor in which we engage together. And I think for the examination of our lives, for thinking about who we are and who we should be, it's this kinds of relationship to others that we need. Well, obviously, we can have many other kinds of relationship, but this is essential. Companionships can be much more superficial. It can be fun, great thing to do. But it's hard to pursue seriously a vision of life worth living if you're simply on your own. I think we see ourselves and we see the world better in company of others. I think sometimes it's hard to find time, hard to keep that time, hard to keep that commitment. And companionships or friendship, rather, with others is essential for that project. It's no accident that monastic communities were founded, or that people gathered in synagogues regularly, or that people went to churches and so forth, so that these kind of sense of belonging together and together exploring is essential.
Right. So maybe I can also tell me if I'm describing the difference correctly. Like, companionship might be two people who sit next to each other at a workplace, at a corporation. And so they might like each other, and their questions that they have for each other is how can we do better work or enjoy work or, you know, be more effective at work. So they're sharing a more simple question, whereas friendship, they're sharing the deeper question of, are we both living a life worth living?
Yeah.
And how do we pursue that?
Yeah. Or they might go, the other companionship might be, I might go after work, I might have a drink and have really good time, which nothing against either of these two forms of companionship. But I think we need generally more, and you describe it quite well what that more might be.
And then another thing that was really fascinating, like I used to always, so you basically describe Pema Chodron's use of the word regret. And it always used to be kind of, you know, when I was growing up and so on, everyone would say, oh, I have no regrets about how I live my life. And I realized for myself that I actually had lots of regrets. And I was relieved to see in your book what Pema Chodron said about regret, that that also almost could be like a compass to show you what direction you're going. Maybe you could describe the four steps of regret that she talks about.
You know, I should reread those. I can't. I know exactly what you what you're talking about. Do you know where the
I'll find it, because you know I know what you mean.
Yeah, like, yeah.
I often have to reread my own writing to remember to remember the things I wrote.
Hold on, and some
I'll yeah. find it, and then here we go. She says, "You're right. The elemental struggle," she says, "is with our feeling of being wrong, with our guilt and shame at what we are." And she says there are four factors, and first there's regret, but then you say it's not wallowing in guilt; it's liberating, because you admit that you're wrong and you're fine with that. You're not trying; you give up your self-defense mechanisms. And the second one is recognizing your personal failures for what they are. You refrain, but you refrain compassionately. You don't yell at yourself, yeah. "Oh, I can't believe I did that. Damn it. Why did I do that?"
Yeah.
And then the third is you basically decide not to do it again. And basically that's the third and the fourth, is you decide not to keep doing these errors and not to do them again.
Yeah, so that's one mode of dealing with failures in variety of forms of failures, miss opportunities, or something like that in life. Yeah, different traditions have different ways of doing it. I think it's very helpful, especially not to let regret kind of hold you captive, but rather to kind of regret lightly enough that you can move positively forward. And, you know, in the Christian tradition, there's a sense of repentance. There's a sense of asking for, apologizing to others. There's a sense, if you've done something wrong, to kind of restore that which you have injured by that. And the sense of my own apology, my own regrets, is already a first step towards something new. Because unless I recognize something as wrong, I can't turn away from it. So I think regrets are when properly handled, are very useful and important things, because they confer value, or they express that we value life as we have lived, and therefore not want to have lived it in a kind of mindless way, or ways that hurt others or hurt ourselves. So regret serves a very important function, and most of the traditions have a way of dealing with a failure to achieve our intended way of life.
And I like how she views regret, like it's very important to have regrets compassionately. Like, you don't yell at yourself like, "I shouldn't have done that," but you use it as a way to move closer to yourself by understanding, you know, or reframing these actions from the past.
Yeah. You know, I think when I talk, in different things that I do, I often speak quite a bit about forgiveness. It's one of the themes on which I've published. And when I speak, it's really interesting how attentive audiences become when you start talking about forgiveness. And because we all have this experience, often we don't want to admit it, but deep down we all have experience of having failed and having not being able either to forgive or to be forgiven what we have done. And almost regularly I encounter the question, "Well, but what do I do when I can't forgive myself?"
And what do you say?
So I respond as a Christian theologian, and in the Christian Bible, in the New Testament, that there is a very interesting line which says, "When your heart accuses you, know that God is greater than your heart." Meaning the God who has forgiven you is greater than your heart. In some ways, there is a kind of word that has been said over you and appreciation, you can make it analogy to somebody loves you completely irregardless of whether you have committed this deed, made that failure or not. And you can then get out of it into light with the help of just that love directed toward you.
Since you're a Christian theologian, let me ask you a question from the New Testament about that. And so there's the famous story in the New Testament, and correct me if I make any details wrong, but there's Jesus with the adulteress. So there's a woman that the crowd is about to stone, and Jesus basically sits in between them and the woman, in between the crowd that wants to kill this woman and the woman. And, you know, he essentially says, anybody here who hasn't committed a single sin, you can throw the first stone. And then he just kind of ignores what's happening, and one by one, they leave because they've all committed a sin. And he himself says, I too can't throw the first stone. So he says to the woman, just go home and don't do it again. So do you think he is also saying that, you know, he has committed a sin, but he loves himself and so he's forgiven himself? Like, what do you think he's saying about himself in that story?
Yeah, I don't think that the story is, he says, neither do I condemn you.
Okay. So he doesn't put himself in with the crowd.
He doesn't put himself in with the crowd who would potentially, who have come to throw the stones. They cannot condemn you, but I will not condemn you either. So I think he puts himself on the side of the mercy. And there's a part in this story where he writes with his finger on the ground.
Yeah,
and it's mysterious what was he writing there, whether there is any sense in which we can divine that. And there are all sorts of conjectures. Maybe he was writing their sins on the ground so that they couldn't throw that first stone at her.
And why do you think the author of that decided to include that detail and not say what he was writing?
I have no idea. It has puzzled interpreters, and I think one interpretation is as good as another because nobody knows.
And what do you think the Stoics, on the other hand, thought about regret, since they were very much about living a life of virtue? If, let's say, there's something from their past that they disapproved of, how do you think they dealt with regret?
I'd have to refresh my knowledge of Stoicism, but as emotion, I think this kind of negative emotion, just like fear or hope, my understanding is that they would want to simply diminish it as an emotion. You concentrate on the presence. Fear and hope are not something that you should worry about. Therefore, also how you deal with the past, you would deal in a kind of analogous way.
So it's almost like both kind of solutions are worthy of following. But on one side, you have, it's okay to have regrets, but just deal with yourself compassionately. And on the other hand, the Stoics, or maybe Buddha, they're not saying don't have regrets, but just it's not important to dwell in it. You know, move forward, and from this point onwards, live a life of virtue, or live a life of contemplation, or, you know, whatever your faith is.
Yeah, and you've got also maybe in the Christian, and I think if I understand correctly, some of the Jewish tradition as well, that there is a kind of mercy there that you ought to have toward yourself and that God has toward you. And since God's word counts, God's decision about your life is fundamental, then you can incorporate that mercy toward yourself into your own life. Those would be some of the alternatives.
What do you think about self-talk? Like, for instance, you indirectly referred to it in that section on regret where you say, you know, have compassion to yourself. Don't say in your head, I'm such an idiot, I did this, you know. So that's an example of negative self-talk. And that sort of sticks to us when we're constantly expressing hatred towards ourselves as opposed to compassion towards ourselves. Do you think there's a role for self-talk in how we live our lives?
You know, maybe some. Self-talk is the mode of stepping, so to say, outside of oneself and looking at oneself and often scolding oneself, right, for what one has done. There may be a positive element in that one identifies the wrong, right? But staying with this self-scolding and constant nagging at oneself seems to me not really productive and not particularly useful. I think either the Buddhist or the Christian way of dealing with it is much much healthier. Either kind of letting the thing simply pass as something that is past, as often one is taught in Buddhist meditation to do, or recognizing and separate yourself from that deed. You are greater than that deed. You yourself are more valuable, and your entire life has not been defined by and ought not to be defined. You ought not to define your life by that wrong that you have committed. You are loved.
Yeah, and also it's interesting looking at the, let's call it the more hedonistic approach, like Oscar Wilde regretted squandering his talent in the pursuit of pleasure. We don't really know whether he hated himself for it or he loved himself for it, but he did use it as a formula for change. You know, yeah. When he got out of jail, he probably still enjoyed the same pleasures, but kind of also shifted a little bit his focus. And so he used it as an agent of change inside of himself. So that's interesting also.
Yeah, or you can do, I think it's one of the options we mentioned in the book also, just forget about the past, concentrate on future. You can do better. Yeah. You can try better. You can try harder.
You know, I the way I sort of, again, it seems like almost like a cliche to say, I don't have any regrets. And a lot of people say it, if I regret anything from the past, I wouldn't be in the life I'm in today. But for myself, I know I had regrets because I have this weird thing where if I'm thinking something that I regret, I have a tendency to blurt out, almost like a Tourette's syndrome, I sort of blurt out a curse. And my kids used to have their friends come over when they were little. And sometimes I'd just be sitting at my computer and I'd curse myself or say out loud a curse. And my kids would say to their friends, oh, daddy just does that sometimes. Ignore him. And then I realized, oh, I do regret things. I can't say, oh, I don't regret anything. But anyway, you know, I really love the book. It's got me asking a lot of questions. You know, and as you put it, you capitalize the Q in question. What is a life worth living? And the book, of course, is called Life Worth Living, A Guide to What Matters Most. Miroslav Volf, that's you, Matthew Crossman, and Ryan McNally-Linz are the three authors. Why does Yale have all these courses on happiness? There's that other woman, Lori Santos, who has a course on happiness too, which is very popular. What's up with Yale and courses on happiness?
Well, you know, there's a distinction between two of our courses on very friendly terms with Laurie. And Laurie has endorsed the book.
Yeah, endorsed she blurred the
back. Yeah, Laurie is asking a very important question that many of the Yale undergrads, and most colleges that I know, experience all the time. They find themselves inadequate to the task of living a life, a college life, as many people find themselves in life more generally. And they need resources and helps, how to get from point A to point B. You have another course in Stanford course, Design Your Life. That's not from psychological standpoint, as Lori does her class, but from the standpoint of design. How do I design my life such that I can get from point A to point B? And I personally think both of these questions are really important. You have to have some technical, quote-unquote, skills in order to live well. You have at the same time to have some psychological skills, capacities in order to do so. Our course is different in that we don't ask the question, how do I get from point A to point B? We're asking the question, what point B is worth getting to? That's the central question of the whole book. They're not mutually exclusive alternatives. Both need to be there. But we feel that in the larger conversation, both in the broader culture and also in the university kinds of settings, that this question of the bee, of what bee is worth getting to, has been neglected. And this book tries to elevate that question to the forefront of our attention.
Well, I love the book. It got me really thinking about a lot of these questions. Also, I encourage people to look at the sections in each chapter where, you know, almost the homework, like you asking these questions. So people just aren't passively reading. You have to answer these questions yourself as the reader, as you read this book. And it's very valuable book, such great stories, so many questions. It got me thinking and considering, you know, and I really appreciate you coming on the podcast and answering my questions to you about the book. But I also just love all the stories in the book and the people you mentioned and so on. So we only touched a little on that, but it is really great stories. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. A wonderful podcast that you have, and it was just a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... I got the charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink?
This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera.
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.